You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the New School for Social Research. The New School for Social Research is a world-renowned graduate school in New York City, offering master's and doctoral programs in the social sciences and humanities. New School students and faculty work to understand social problems through progressive interdisciplinary scholarship and create new ideas in the world. To learn more about the New School for Social Research, visit newschool.edu/NSSR. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Social Europe Podcast. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. First of all, Happy New Year 2020. I hope you and your families have had a good start to the new decade, and I wish you and your loved ones all the best for the years ahead, and above all, health. Today, I'm in conversation with Sarah Kessler, who is the author of a book called Gigged, about the gig economy, and that book also made the long list of the Financial Times and McKinsey Business Book of the Year Award 2018. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, Sarah Kessler, thank you very much indeed for taking the time today to talk to me about the topic of your recent book, Gigged, on the gig economy. And it's obviously a term that has been bandied around quite a bit. And in order to get us going, could you maybe explain to us what the gig economy actually is and what type of worker in these days qualifies actually as a gig worker?
So that's an interesting question because there is no technical definition for who is a gig worker. And it's something that a lot of people have different opinions on, like what counts as a gig worker. You know, some people are only talking really about Uber drivers and other work that you get through an app. The broader definition would be kind of any sort of freelance work that you're doing kind of as yourself rather than as an employee. And then, you know, I like to think about the gig economy as part of a spectrum of things that kind of represent this move away from a traditional job.
Okay. And you are basically chronicling a lot of personal stories in your book. So could you share some of these sort of insights from what people shared with you?
Sure. So one of the things that I wanted to do with the book is represent that kind of this situation is like different for different people. And a lot of times when we talk about the gig economy, people will say this is the worst thing that ever happened. And it's, you know, super exploitative for anybody to work as a freelancer. And then you'll have other people who say, you know, I'm a digital nomad and like being a freelancer is great. It means I work from the beach and can do whatever I want whenever I want. So there's really like many different things going on within this like employment arrangement. And so the people who I followed in the book, like they are very different, come from different places and are having very different experiences working as freelancers or the gig economy. So on one end, one person I followed was like a recent college graduate with a computer science degree, and he was basically bored at work. And so he quit his job and joined this platform called Gigster, which kind of routes programming jobs to programmers, and, you know, made, I think it was $12,000 or $15,000 in his first month. You know, he had been able to save living expenses, so if he didn't want to work a day, he could take the day off and it wouldn't mean he didn't buy groceries. He bought his own health insurance and really found like a new freedom and like an ability to try new things by becoming a freelancer and signing up for the gig economy. And then kind of on the other end, I followed this man named Gary who had a job as a customer service representative, and he was technically a freelancer. But his position was he was a freelancer for a small business that worked for a contractor that had a contract with Sears. So he had kind of this whole like long line of businesses between him and the company for whom he was doing work. And it looks a lot different. Like he was also technically a freelancer or classified that way, but he couldn't choose when he worked. The company told him when to work. Like, if he were to take a day off, he didn't have the savings where he could be comfortable doing that. And sometimes there wasn't work for him to do, and that meant he didn't get paid. And so it was really flexibility for the company instead of for Gary.
And I mean, the balance between the benefits and the downsides of this, does this also correlate with educational level? I mean, the computer scientist that you mentioned, apparently, no, it was basically a demand-driven system. So there was always work for him when he wanted it. So basically, he was in charge of determining really his income, right, based on the amount of hours he wanted to work. But on the other hand, if you're a click worker or paid, you know, by the clicks or by the pennies, and you must be happy that there's actually some work coming along, it's a very different situation.
Right, exactly. And I don't think it's that much different than any job, as the people with, you know, the most access to education and the most money, you know, often end up faring a lot better than the people who are doing jobs that pay less money. I think the difference is the way that we've structured kind of all of our protections around jobs, and in the US, our entire social safety net is based around this definition of employee. So if you're like on the side of things where it's like not a great job, you lose kind of all those protections and that safety net that you would have had if you were technically an employee.
Well, that's obviously the same in Europe, right? So where we have either tax-based social insurance systems or insurance contribution-based systems, as is the case here in Germany. And what a lot of these platforms are doing is basically disintermediating the work and employee-employer relationship by basically putting a platform in between, which creates, you know, especially a financing issue for social security. So what would your solution then be? I mean, would you put a tax on the platform? So basically paying for the social security that otherwise, you know, would be done via the employer. And how would it work? I mean, obviously, I think everybody seems to agree that there should be a higher level of social protection for freelance and gig workers.
Yeah, I think one thing that you could do is move some of those social programs away from like being attached to a job. So for instance, anybody you do work with could contribute some percentage of the work that you do or the pay that you get to the social security system or your health insurance or something like that. And that's a concept called portable benefits. Another solution that's been proposed, particularly for kind of these platform companies, is kind of worker ownership of those platforms. So more of a co-op system where kind of all these people are creating value by coming together and, you know, being available to do the work. And if they could then like take part in some of the value that they are creating, maybe that would be a better situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking through different ownership structures, it's one way of doing it, but that's basically reforming basically where the added value, where the money from the capital goes to. But if you just want to be an employee, I mean, I think there was in Spain, there were recent law cases and court judgment that I think, I can't remember which was it, whether it was Uber drivers or a similar situation, that legally they had to be employed. So where would you actually draw the line between, you know, what is a gig worker, what is a freelancer, and what is somebody who would actually like to be employed in a regular employment situation but is forced into this type of irregular employment?
How would I decide who was who?
Yeah, so basically if you are willing to work in that kind of situation, right? And and say, you know, I have a benefits and the downsides I can mitigate one way or the other. But it's also the case that at least in Europe, a lot of these gig workers seem to be pushed into these type of employments in lieu of a regular employment, which would give them not just sick pay, holiday pay, insurance, all of these sort of bedrock or some of these economic building blocks you actually need for, say, if you want to start a family, you buy a house, so these sort of things. So it's the knock-on effect. So if it's your choice and you want to do this, fine. But, you know, how would you try to avoid people being pushed into these situations, you know, against their will effectively?
Yeah, I think part of it is that it's not really clear who's an employee and who's a freelancer. So that gives companies like, you know, a gray area, which, I, you know, some would argue it's not gray, but a way to say people we're treating like employees and functioning as employees are actually freelancers. And the reason that they're incentivized to do that is because we have this kind of two bucket system where employees get all these rights and freelancers don't get all these rights. And I kind of like thinking about the problem more is like, maybe that system isn't making as much sense. And is there a different system where, you know, everybody has some sort of social safety net that's not necessarily attached to this job status? I think people care less about whether or not they're an employee than whether or not they have health insurance.
But as the two are often related. I mean, one of the tests, for instance, in Germany, where I'm now based, there's a fake self-employment law. And one of the tests is if you effectively just work for one company, rather than you would expect a freelancer to have a source of different companies that they work with. You know, if you literally just work for one company all the time, that's a signal that it might be a fake self-employment because it's basically that company should offer you a regular job.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of tests. California just passed a law. It says, like, if your work is, like, part of the main business of the company, then you're an employee. So there's been all these solutions focused on sorting people into buckets. But there's no natural order of things that says, you know, that freelancers should be much less expensive and should be like denied kind of all of these rights that employees have. Like, why isn't there a way that freelancers can participate in like unions in the United States? And when I say union, I mean like under federal union laws. I just think like there's a lot of talk about classification, and maybe that's not exactly the best way to think about the problem, or that's like the most immediate sign of the problem. But the problem is maybe that work is changing and people are changing. You know, the world is changing and like our labor laws haven't. So, you know, if you think about when we came up with this idea that a job should be a 9-to-5 thing, where you go to the same place and it should last all year, that is not a very old concept, actually. It's, you know, Industrial Revolution. And when we were making it, we thought like, oh, you would have to go to an office to do work because that's where the files are. That's where the factory is. And it's more and more not the case. And we thought, okay, it makes sense that somebody's doing this from 9-to-5 every day with no flexibility because obviously they're only men working and there's somebody who's working at home for free, you know, woman. So that makes sense. And that is obviously like very much not the case anymore, as much as it ever really was the case. So I think a lot of things are changing and we have this mindset of what a job is, and all the rules around like protecting workers are based around that.
Yeah, but I mean, there are some sort of legal minimums that are enshrined in law. For instance, I mean, we talked about the benefits of health insurance and social benefits and so on and so forth. But for instance, there are also statutory minimum wages in many countries. So, I mean, how would you try to enforce those minimum wages also on the platforms? This obviously does not apply to the computer scientist who makes $15,000 a month with this type of work, but in a more precarious part of that sector. You know, there's quite a bit of evidence that there's exploitation and people are working for much less than should be. Well, it's the legal minimum wage. So, and obviously there's also a cross-border issue. You know, if you just buy via one of these platforms, a freelancer from somewhere else in the world, right? So, what state, you know, what kind of rules should apply? You know, what are your ideas? I mean, how would sort of that kind of messy situation, how could that be cleared up a little bit?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, at some point you're talking about globalization and like the problems of thinking through the benefits and drawbacks of that. I mean, hiring a freelancer digitally through a program that's doing design work, you know, in India it's not necessarily like it's a similar problem to, you know, people moving factories all around the world to find the cheapest labor. And I don't know if I'm the best person to answer like that question. New York City actually imposed like a minimum wage for Uber drivers, which is interesting. And it's not necessarily like a flat, like hourly rate. There's like some sort of calculation that happens that I don't quite know how to explain off the top of my head. But it doesn't seem like it's impossible to time how long somebody is doing work. It doesn't seem like an impossible problem.
Yeah. Uber
work.
Yeah. Uber might be a slightly easier case, luckily in that sense, because they're, even though it's an app, but they are delivering a local service. So whether they're driving in London, in Berlin, or in Chicago or New York, it's still local regulation, city by city, that basically sets the standard, as it does mm-hmm. for the competitors, the cabs and other taxi services. But, you know, if you're talking about a service that is completely fulfilled digitally, you mm-hmm. send off a file or you do some sort of computer-based work somewhere else in the world, this is probably where it gets really tricky to determine, you know, what should apply. And how to enforce any sort of standards that you would like to apply to these type of works.
Yes, I think it is. Yeah, that is where it gets tricky.
And where would you see basically, where are we going if you look forward into the development? So where would you generally see the benefits of the gig economy, broadly speaking, right? And do you have any ideas of how to address some of these challenges? Would that be a local thing? Should that be a national thing? Would you talk about international agreements? You know, how would you go about trying to save all the benefits and try to address some of the downsides?
Yeah, so I think the idea that we should do work in a different way or in a project-based way makes a lot of sense. Like if you think about a company as like, the way that it's currently managed, it's like you will do all this work because you fit at this place in the structure. But what if it were like every project you had, you gathered the people who were best to do that specific project, and after it was over, it kind of dissipated and went around. I mean, there's an opportunity for business there. There's an opportunity for people who need flexibility and actually want to, you know, like I was saying before, now most people live in, you know, there's a lot of families where there's two people who are working and trying to balance childcare around that is, notoriously a difficult problem. Like maybe this could help with that. People are living longer. There's a book called The 100-Year Life. And I went to a talk and its author said that he thought about naming it The 60-Year Career. But then he thought no one would buy the book if it were called The 60-Year Career. 100-Year Life sounds like a much more fun thing. But that's the truth, is that people are living longer and able to work longer. And maybe when you're of what we've considered retirement age, you're not ready to just like stop working altogether, but aren't, you know, don't necessarily want to do a 9-to-5 job anymore. Maybe there's some middle ground in the gig economy. So I do think there's a lot of opportunities that make sense. It's just we have no way to support them. You know, we have no way to support this kind of work, which again, like in the Industrial Revolution, when we decided this was the job thing, we didn't really have any structures to support the 9-to-5 job either. You know, we didn't have child labor laws. It was legal to lock people inside of factories that might burn down. And then, through this long period, things didn't get perfect, but we built structures that made things better for people who are working. And so there's no reason we can't build those same type of things for this kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the process. I mean, the Industrial Revolution, well, it originally did not come with the 9-to-5 job, right? So that was the pushback.
Right.
Yeah, that was the pushback, by unions, by workers against these circumstances. And we basically found later on a kind of equilibrium where, you know, there was always a constant struggle between, and there's always bound to be sort of conflicting interests and the balance being struck between these interests. But you ameliorated the worst parts of the working conditions. So that was basically a long process. And we are, maybe similar in a similar process now, where you have to deal with some of these things that are cutting across. But where you we're absolutely right. I mean, I think the old idea that retirement is a date in the future when you just stop working and just do gardening, that's probably a thing of the past. So how you, especially against the backdrop of a much longer life expectancy that you now have, being flexible and doing much less work, and also maybe you want to do more work when you're older and less work when you are have small children, right? Building work more flexibly around the life demands of people, that's probably one of the areas where this can be pushed to improve people's lives.
Yeah, and I also would make the point that I don't think that, like, I think that the the system we have now isn't necessarily even working well for people who are employed. There's a lot of the same kind of precariousness same precarity in having a job where you're working at a fast food restaurant and you're an employee, but you don't get your schedule till the week before. And maybe it's like our algorithms have determined that you should work this 2-hour shift in the morning and then a 4-hour shift later in the afternoon. And it doesn't make any sense. In the US, employees are paying, even if they have health insurance from their employer, more and more of the premiums, they're going up. The pension system is kind of over and it's becoming less of a safety net. So I think fixing and rethinking these problems for the gig economy could ultimately help everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you probably have to fix some of these issues, some of these abuses that you have in the labor code. I mean, I know in the UK there has been a big discussion about zero-hour contracts. I'm not sure whether you've come across that, which is basically you're an employee, but the contract says 0 hours. And any hours you get for work are basically determined the evening before or the day before. So yeah, for all intents and purposes, you are at the mercy of, whatever the employer wants to give you. But legally speaking, you don't count as a freelancer or a temp worker or contract worker because you're employed on a 0-hour contract.
Right. Like, they figured out how to insulate themselves from legal attacks, saying like these are actually employees without really giving any more commitment.
That's right. It's a blatant abuse of the labor code, but at the moment it still allows it. You're having all the downsides of being at the mercy of your employer, whilst technically, legally being employed, but without any guarantee of any sort of secure work. And that has been a big discussion in the UK for many years. So I think you're right when you point out that, even in the existing systems, there have obviously been these sort of abuses. It's probably the challenge how you build a system that provides for a security of work in that sense, right? So maybe not in your terms, the security of employment, if that is not what you are striving for, what you want. But if you have mortgage payments to do and it's impossible for you to find any work in any given month or so, I mean, that's also a very, very stressful situation. So it basically relies on an abundance of supply of that type of work, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think when a lot of these platforms launched, kind of their pitch was you can press a button and get work whenever you want. And that's not the reality. Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned
available at the time when it's available. Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you were certain that, at any time I log onto, say, Mechanical Turk or any other platform, I could get work that would earn me X amount per hour, that would be a different story. But that's not the case, and it's creating a lot of stress for people who then struggle to make an income. And I think you chronicled also, especially the story of of somebody who worked for Mechanical Turk, right? So could you give us a bit of background on this story?
I followed this woman. Who lives in Canada, who her husband lost his job at a warehouse, and she had never worked outside of the home before, but she found this website, Mechanical Turk, which is this platform where, there are thousands of people on it, and companies go and put tasks that are often pretty small, things like label this photo, and then you get paid kind of cents per every task you do. And she managed to make it work and earn like $40,000 a year, 3 cents at a time, essentially, or like very small payments. So on one hand, you are probably happy that she was able to find the solution. And when she had no other options, it did end up like giving her enough money to survive. But if you look closer at it, it's not really like a situation that we can feel that good about. So like she set up all these systems where like the computer would actually set off an alarm if there was like a good task posted, like one where she thought she could make money on it. And then she would like run from wherever she was in the house and like claim the task and like sleep in her office so that she wouldn't miss one overnight. She got injured. Like, you know, a lot of this requires a lot of like repetitive clicking, and her like elbow and shoulder had injuries, and she couldn't take any time off because she needed the money. There's no sick days. She decided not to get the surgery because although like the consultation was covered by the public insurance in Canada, if she were to have the surgery, she would be responsible for buying the drugs, and she couldn't afford that without supplemental insurance. So it just like doesn't look very, it's like we could probably do better. And so yeah, that was kind of the takeaway there. So that conundrum of, it's great that this is available, but why does it have to look like this? Yeah.
So, I mean, shouldn't be, you know, if she had a timer to set, you know, for the good jobs, I mean, shouldn't any job being posted there, so at least adhere to some sort of minimum, right? So that, you know, if it's a 3 cent job, it's probably costing somebody more time that is worth more than 3 cents, but just posting that job than actually getting a job done, right? So, I mean...
Yeah, of debate. So she was also involved in this movement of workers, you know, congregated and like an online platform, and like, what can we do to influence our working conditions? What can we ask for from Amazon? And there was like debate kind of among the people who work on the platform, like, do we want a minimum wage, or would that just discourage people from posting work? Or would that mean that people in Canada and the US wouldn't get any of the work? Or would that mean like people would stop hiring people in India? And like US and North America would start getting all the work, because before it was cheaper to hire people in India and now it's not. I mean, so it gets complicated when they're deciding, like even among themselves, like what are the things we would want.
And was this unionization attempt successful? I mean, did they manage to, you know, improve the working conditions for themselves?
No. I think they ran into that problem. And then also the way that they were signing people up for the site, where they were talking amongst themselves about like, what actions can we do? They would post a task on Mechanical Turk that said, you know, use this code and you can sign up from our web, like for our union chat room. And the reason they wanted to do that is so like random people couldn't join. So Amazon flagged that task and said it was against the terms of services and kind of canceled their way of gathering people. And they could do that because there's no like federally protected right to unionize if you're not an employee. So that it wasn't as though that was a protected group that, you know, they could then go to the government and say they're retaliating against us for trying to unionize.
Right. So it was one attempt, but a largely unsuccessful one.
Yes, they did get a lot of media attention. They wrote a letter to Jeff Bezos about like how they didn't feel that they were being treated as human on the platform, and that people looked at them as kind of another piece of code. And that got picked up by a lot of papers and a lot of distribution. So I think that was the big win of the attempt, is just getting attention focused on the issue. But there weren't meaningful changes that Amazon made.
Right. So, well, in the long run, probably more challenges going forward than we've settled so far. I mean, there are obviously the cases where there are clear advantages, you know, flexibility. But, you know, if you find a model that, you know, combines that flexibility for, you know, people's life and without the stress that comes with if they feel threatened or, you know, as a piece of code, as a result of it. That's probably the balance that will have to be struck, but we're quite, as far as I can see, quite far away from this. But Sarah Kessler, thank you very much indeed again for taking the time to speak to me today. And obviously, well, you probably continue to work in this area. So this is not a topic that's going to go away anytime soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.